This is week 37. This is about Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, one author says he was the greatest and most powerful of all Babylonian kings. I would disagree and say that he was and still stands as the greatest of all kings. I would qualify that further and say all Gentile kings, because our king, the King of Israel, the Lord Jesus Christ, is and will be King of Kings. He will stand at the top of the long line of the world's kings. He is both King of the Jews and King of the Gentiles. Why do I make that point? Because many historians and Bible teachers only see Nebuchadnezzar as a prideful and wicked king. Among Jewish scholars, he is a hated king, the destroyer of Jerusalem and the temple. He is all those things. But there is much more to it. I want to show you Nebuchadnezzar in a new light, to try to show him the way the Lord describes him and the way the Lord treats him. In many ways, I see myself in him, my pride and my arrogance. But through that, I see God's grace and the trial that he brings as the way to humble me and to restore me to sanity. Yes, sanity. Seeing things as they really are, and not as I wish them to be. So Nebuchadnezzar, who is he? What factors shape his life? How is he the instrument of the discipline for Israel? How is he transformed into what God wants him to be? We must start in his family, that core structure of all society, the soil in which we all develop, for better or for worse. Nebuchadnezzar was the oldest son of Nabopolassar. As the eldest, he was the crown prince, heir to the throne. His father, Nabopolassar, was a high official in the Assyrian Empire. He was an Assyrian, and he led a rebellion against his Assyrian masters and declared himself king of Babylon. Now, imagine this man. Imagine the strength of will and the pride and the confidence it takes to lead a rebellion that leads to the eventual takeover of a great world power like Assyria. This is the soil of Nebuchadnezzar's life. He reflects the character of his father, and he becomes an even greater leader and a conqueror. And God is working behind the scenes all the time. God is going to bring him to an even greater power and to prepare him to rule over God's own people. We see this in 2 Chronicles chapter 35. In chapter 35, verses 20 through 24, it says, after King Josiah had done all this for the temple, and remember, Josiah had completely reformed the temple and brought about one of the best Passovers in history. But this is later in his kingship. And it goes on to say that King Necho of Egypt led an army to fight at Carchemish on the Euphrates River. The last Assyrian stronghold was in Carchemish up on the Euphrates River, and the Egyptians were going there to fight with the Assyrians against Babylon. The verse goes on to say, Josiah tried to stop him, but Necho sent Josiah this message. Quote, this war I am fighting does not concern you, King of Judah. I have not come to fight you, but to fight my enemies. And God has told me to hurry. God is on my side, so don't oppose me or he will destroy you. But Josiah was determined to fight. He refused to listen to what God was saying through King Necho. So he disguised himself and went into battle on the plain of Megiddo. I want to say that Josiah, notice what it says here, Josiah was determined to fight. Notice, he doesn't seek the Lord. The Lord would have told him to listen to Necho. He acted like Ahab, the most wicked king of Israel. He even disguised himself like Ahab. The verse goes on to say this. During the battle, King Josiah was struck by Egyptian arrows. He ordered his servants, take me away, I'm badly hurt. They lifted him out of his chariot, placed him in a second chariot, which he had there with him, and took him to Jerusalem. There he died. Notice, he died like Ahab, wounded by a random arrow. But notice the last words of the verse. and was buried in the royal tombs. See, his lapse did not bring disgrace, only defeat. He is buried with honor. So the Egyptians go on to Carchemish after defeating Josiah's army. They go on to fight the battle at Carchemish with the Assyrians, but they lose, and they do manage to keep an armed force there. So they maintain a presence in Carchemish because Nebuchadnezzar and his army pulls back. Necho also took control of Jerusalem at the same time, and what he does then is, after Josiah dies, he puts Jehoiakim on the throne as his puppet king, and he demands tribute. Now, Necho held Carchemish and Jerusalem until Nebuchadnezzar's army came back and defeated him. Now Nebuchadnezzar had control of Judah and Jerusalem. And this is exactly the way God wanted it to go, which is exactly why there was no reason for Josiah to disobey God and to fight the Egyptians in the first place. But now Josiah is gone, and Nabopolassar dies while Nebuchadnezzar is fighting this very battle. So now Nebuchadnezzar is king. Nebuchadnezzar is now king. And this year is 606-605. It's a very important date. Nebuchadnezzar has defeated Jerusalem at this point. Now, Nebuchadnezzar has to return to Babylon to take his crown and to go back and mourn for his father. But he doesn't go back empty-handed. He doesn't just pack up and go from Carchemish. He goes down to Jerusalem and he takes some captives with him. Now, this is the year Daniel is taken to Babylon, 605. We see this in Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. And Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 says this: "In the third year that Jehoiakim was king of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia attacked Jerusalem and surrounded the city. The Lord let him," notice that, "the Lord let him capture Jehoiakim and seize some of the temple treasures." Now, what he took was the gold stuff. He took the gold stuff out of the Holy of Holies, the candelabra, etc. "And he took some of the prisoners back with him to the temple of his gods in Babylon." The Lord let him do this. "And he put the captured treasures in the temple storerooms." Remember, the Lord let him do this. Then in verse 3, "The king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief official, to select from among the Israelites, exiles, some young men of the royal family and of the noble families." So what Nebuchadnezzar wanted here, he wanted to capture the best of the best, the cream of the crop. He took the people with the money and the power. He's going to use them in his own kingdom. And down to verse 1:6, it says that among those chosen were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all of whom were from the tribe of Judah. That's the tribe of the king, the royal tribe. What Nebuchadnezzar does not know when he takes these three teenage boys captive, and what we do not see on the surface of it, is that Daniel and his friends will have a far greater impact on Nebuchadnezzar than he will have on them, though he does everything he can to mold them into fine young Babylonian citizens of his world. So what he does is, before he leaves, he left Jehoiakim on the throne. He leaves him there as his puppet king. So Jehoiakim goes from being a puppet king of Egypt to a puppet king of Babylon. But Jehoiakim's sick of this. He rebelled. So Nebuchadnezzar came back, and Jehoiakim is killed, and Nebuchadnezzar puts his son Jehoiachin, looks like Jehoiachin, in his place. And remember, Jehoiachin's other name is Coniah. But Jehoiachin rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, which the Lord saw as a sin against himself. The Lord sees this as a sin against himself. So after 3 months on the throne, Jehoiachin is taken captive and taken to Babylon, along with thousands of the people and the artisans of the middle class. Now he strips away the middle class. This was 597 BC. Then Nebuchadnezzar installs a new king, Jehoiakim's uncle, Jehoiachin, if you read it that way. His uncle, his name is Mattaniah, but he changes his name to Zedekiah, and he leaves him on the throne. Will he do any better than the first two? Will he submit to Nebuchadnezzar's authority? No. He rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, and that is the final rebellion. And now we come to the big date, 586 BC. Because after about 11 years on the throne, Zedekiah has been so rebellious and so obstinate. In fact, he's even joined the anti-Babylon party along with the Philistines and some other nations around him to fight against Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar's done. So he comes to the big date, 586 BC, the year that the city and the temple were completely destroyed. Just as Jeremiah said, wiped like a plate. Flipped over and wiped again. This day of Jerusalem's destruction is called Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av means the ninth of Av, a month on the Hebrew calendar. It is the day the Jews mourn for Jerusalem every year in the summertime. And it is also the reason they hate the name Nebuchadnezzar. They see him only as a wicked destroyer, an agent of the devil. But as we look at him in the book of Daniel, we see that that is not quite true. For one thing, the Jewish people had been well warned in advance what the Lord was going to do. Nebuchadnezzar is God's instrument for judgment. He's the tool for judgment in God's hands. The Lord had made this clear through Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 25, Jeremiah had said this in verse 9. Jeremiah 25:9 says, I will send for all the peoples from the north and send for my servant, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia, and I'm going to bring them to fight against Judah and its inhabitants and against all the neighboring nations. These are all the nations that had formed this anti-Babylon coalition, this anti-Babylon party. He goes on to say, I am going to destroy this nation and its neighbors and leave them in ruins forever, a terrible and shocking sight. I, the Lord, have spoken. Jeremiah 27:6 says, I am the one who has placed all these nations under the power of my servant, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia, and I have made even the wild animals serve him. But if any nation or kingdom will not submit to his rule, then I will punish that nation by war, starvation, and disease until I have let Nebuchadnezzar destroy it completely. And God is warning here that warns the nation that any person in the nation who will not submit will suffer the same fate. Now think of this. Jesus came later, and he also warned the Jewish people what the Lord was going to do through the Romans, who destroyed Jerusalem again in 70 AD. And you know what day that destruction took place? That day that the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD was on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, the same day. So when the Jews celebrate or they mourn Tisha B'Av, they're mourning the destruction of two temples under two completely different empires. Now let's go back to Daniel and look more closely at this greatest of all Gentile kings. And we will start in Daniel 2, where Nebuchadnezzar has a very disturbing dream, and he wants to know what it means. And in Daniel 2, verse 3, it says, and the king said to them, is his Chaldean priests and magi, he says, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. He is so troubled, he's unable to sleep. That's how anxious he is. He's kind of having a panic attack here. And so what has him so upset? This is a great and powerful king. I mean, he's conquered all these nations. He controls everything. And what makes him even more upset is that his wisest men cannot tell him what it means. And the king hears about a young man named Daniel, who's a young teenage boy in his court, who's in training. And Daniel tells him that with the help of the Lord, who is the God of Israel, he can both tell him the dream and he can interpret that dream. See, so the king's not telling anybody the dream. He doesn't want to tell them the dream and then let them make something up. Daniel says, I can both tell you the dream and what it means. And so down in chapter 2 verse 31, Daniel tells him the dream that he saw. And he says, you saw, O king, and behold, you saw a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. That's why he's so anxious and upset. Daniel goes on in 32, the head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and its arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, so not a trace of them could be found. But that stone that struck the image, that became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now imagine. You don't have to, well, just go back to that day, September 11, 2001, when those two buildings in New York, they're burning at the top, they're on fire, and what happens all of a sudden? They collapse. They collapse as if they collapse from the bottom to the top. They just collapse down into a heap. That's what happens to this image. It collapses into a heap of dust that the wind blows away. And this great mountain fills the whole earth. What could that be? What could that be? We're going to go on with Daniel's interpretation. Here's what he tells Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, verse 37. You, O king, the king of kings. That's a way of saying the greatest of all kings. To whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory. And into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven. Look at the control he has here. And he says, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. You, O king, are the head, the gold head over everything. Now that is an ego builder. So what has him so disturbed? Why is he so frightened? Why is he so upset? Because Daniel said at the very beginning, this is a frightening image. Because this image says his kingdom ends. And this image says that the whole image, the whole system is destroyed by a mysterious stone from heaven. And this heaven, this stone from heaven fills the whole earth. What's that mean? That stone that came from heaven is going to become the kingdom of heaven on this earth. And Nebuchadnezzar seems to understand at this point that there is someone greater than he is. And he sees Daniel in a new light. Think of it. Here is a king, just like his father, Nabopolassar. He's proud. He's strong. He's seemingly in control of his life. And this is what he says to Daniel. 2:46 and 47. Here's his response. Then King Nebuchadnezzar bowed to the ground and gave orders for sacrifices and offerings to be made for Daniel. The king said, your God is the greatest of all gods, the Lord over kings and the one who reveals mysteries. I know this because you've been able to explain this mystery. Not only explain the mystery, he told him the dream. He tells Daniel, your God is greater than my gods. Now, is this a change of heart? Is he truly humbled before the true God? You know, it might seem like it if Daniel had not written the next chapter. Chapter 3, verse 1 says, King Nebuchadnezzar had a gold statue made, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and had it set up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. This is a big, huge plain in Babylon. It holds thousands of people. And it seems here as if once Nebuchadnezzar thought about that dream, he thought, you know, I am the head of gold, and I don't see any reason for my kingdom to end. So his proud, ego-driven mind, which he, like father, like son, has created an everlasting kingdom in his mind. And here is his image as he sees it now, a kingdom that is gold from head to foot. And he is saying, yes, there is a great God in Israel, but I am in charge here. I am king of Babylon. Now, look at verse 3. When all these officials on this plain of Dura, when all these officials gathered for the dedication and stood in front of the statue, there was an announcement, a loud announcement for everybody to hear. Verses 5 and 6 said, you are to bow down and worship the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Anyone who does not bow down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. And Daniel's three friends are there. Their names are now Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They have new Babylonian names. They will not bow. They say, kill us if you must, but, and here's their answer in 3:17 and 18, if the God whom we serve is able to save us from the blazing furnace and from your power, then he will. But if he doesn't, your majesty may be sure that we will not worship your God. We will not bow down to this gold statue that you have set up. They are clearly saying to his face, we will not worship you. And he goes into a fit of arrogant, passionate rage. And he orders the furnace to be made seven times hotter. And he throws them into the fire. And their great God they worship, he spared them. They told him that's possible. Spared them. Why? Why does he spare them? Because this is another lesson, not just for us, but for Nebuchadnezzar. God is telling him, trust me. See how I take care of my own? You can throw them into fire. They don't even smell like smoke. See how I take care of those who are loyal to me alone and will not bow to you? And look what he does. Look what Nebuchadnezzar does in 3:28 and 29. Go down to 3:28. The king said, praise the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel and rescued these men who serve and trust him. They disobeyed my orders and risked their lives rather than bow down and worship any god except their own. See, what that says is he's really impressed by their loyalty to their God. He's starting to think, I wish I had such servants with that loyalty. In verse 29, and now I command, that means law. When he says I command, that means that's a law right there at that point. That if anyone of any nation, race, or language speaks disrespectfully of the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he is to be torn limb from limb. And his house is to be made a pile of ruins. The King James has a more picturesque language here. They say a dung heap. And you all know what that is. Now, this is a law he will enforce. And that's how he will enforce it. And he goes on to say this. There is no other God who can rescue like this. So just as he did with Daniel, he sees there is no God greater than this. Truly a God who may, just maybe, be even greater than he is. A God who really is in control of everything, even fire. Now again, is this a heart change? Is this real humility? Is this a desire to take this God as his own God? Not yet. Not yet. But notice the arrogant rage that he showed before. It's gone. It's gone. But are his problems over? He has another dream. A dream even more upsetting than the last one. And just like the last time, none of the Magi wise men could tell him what it meant. Or maybe they were afraid to tell him what it meant. Now you can read the whole dream in Daniel 4, but I'm going to summarize it here. He is telling his dream to Daniel. Daniel is a chief magi himself. He trusts Daniel. Here's Daniel 4, 10 through 15. I've summarized these verses. He tells Daniel, while I was asleep, I had a vision of a huge tree in the middle of the earth. And it grew until it stretched to the sky and could be seen by everyone in the world. And I saw coming down from heaven an angel, alert and watchful. And he said, cut the tree down and chop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Drive the animals from under it and the birds out of its branches. But leave the stump in the ground with a band of iron and bronze around it. Leave it there in the field with the grass. Now, you have to understand, this is a story told by Nebuchadnezzar himself. You want to keep that in mind. This is his story. He is the one who wrote this chapter in our Bibles, in Aramaic, his language. And the vision from the angel about a tree cut down, secured with a bronze iron band around the stump, suddenly becomes much more personal, because 4:15 goes on to say this: "Now let the dew fall on this man." What? I thought this was talking about a tree. No. He says, "And let him live. Let him live with the animals and the plants. For 7 years, he will not have a human mind, but the mind of an animal." This is not about a tree anymore. And I think he senses this, but he can't understand it. Now he wants Daniel to tell him what it all means. And he notices Daniel, once he hears the dream, he notices his demeanor, and Daniel is so alarmed he doesn't want to interpret it. And so in verse 4:19, it tells us what the king says. The king said to him, "Belteshazzar," that's Daniel's Babylonian name, "don't let the dream and its message alarm you." Belteshazzar replied, "Your Majesty, I wish that the dream and its explanation applied to you and your enemies and not to you." Then Daniel tells him what it means. And the bottom line is this, verses 24 through 26. Daniel says, "This then is what it means, Your Majesty. And this is what the Most High has declared will happen to you. You will be driven away from human society and will live with wild animals. For 7 years you will eat grass like an ox and sleep in the open air where the human dew will fall on you. Then you will admit that the Most High controls all human kingdoms and that he can give them to anyone he chooses." The angel ordered the stump to be left in the ground. "This means that you will become king again when you acknowledge that the Most High rules all the world." Now the word for God here is Elyon. Now Elyon is the word that means the majestic, the high, the majestic high God who controls all. The emphasis is on the God who overlooks and controls everything in his entire creation. Now note what it said in verse 26. "When you acknowledge." That really is a stronger form of that word in verse 25, admit. It means admit, but it means more than that. It means to confess that this God controls even you. "Then you will be restored." But now Daniel makes an appeal to him. He says to him in verse 27, "So then, Your Majesty, follow my advice." Now, when he says, "follow my advice," he is asking him to listen and to humble himself now. Now, what is Daniel's advice? Now, I've never been sure of this, and I'm not saying this is absolutely right, but this is the way I see it. Does Daniel think the king can avoid this 7 years as a beast if he will follow his advice today? It seems he is. I can't think of any other reason than he would say this. It says that everything that Daniel says next is a call to change, what we call repentance. Because look what he says. He says, "Follow my advice. Number one, stop sinning. Number two, start doing what is right. And number three, be merciful to the poor. Then you will continue to be prosperous." He's telling him in words I would put it, I said, "Then you will be a blessed man, and a blessed man prospers." I hope you know Psalm 1 well enough to recognize that line. The blessed man prospers in all that he does. But he doesn't change. Well, maybe he does, a little bit, but not for long. Not for long, because the following year, he has long enough time has gone by for this upsetting dream thing to kind of fade. It kind of calms down. And so his story continues. And remember, it's Nebuchadnezzar telling us this. He's using the third person as if he's talking about someone else. But he's talking about himself. Down in verse 29, chapter 4, verse 29, verse 30, 29 to 31. Verse 29. "Only 12 months later, while he was walking around on the roof of his royal palace in Babylon, he said, Look how great Babylon is. I built it as my capital city to display my power and might, my glory and majesty. Before the words were out of his mouth, a voice spoke from heaven. And it said this, King Nebuchadnezzar, listen to what I say. Your royal power is now taken away. Verse 33, the words came true immediately. Nebuchadnezzar was driven out of human society and ate grass like an ox. The dew fell on his body and his hair grew as long as eagle feathers and his nails as long as bird claws. He is helpless. He has become a beast. He has lost all human capacity. Most importantly, he has lost his pride as well as his position. He is humiliated. He's in a field eating grass. He doesn't bathe. He doesn't shave. He doesn't cut his hair. He doesn't cut his fingernails. He is doing whatever it is that an animal does. And you know, that in a way is a wonderful thing. Because I think he's protected. And I think he's content. Because he's doing what animals were created to do. Animals do what they were created to do. And in doing what they do, they show God's glory in being animals. They don't disobey God by anything they do. They truly are serving him. And his protector, that bronze iron band around the stump of the cut down tree, I believe it is Daniel. I think it's Daniel, that young boy that the Lord sent to Nebuchadnezzar years before. And what I see in all this is we can see how God works all things together, to what lengths he will go to save a proud, proud man, and how Daniel is blessed as one who gains God's approval for his faith and for his faithfulness in serving the king that God had said back to Jeremiah, this is my king, you submit to him. And Daniel has risen to great heights in the government of Babylon. Daniel has prospered in all that he does. And he has been divinely prepared. Now listen to Nebuchadnezzar in the first person now. Notice the pronoun shift. He's going to talk about himself in the first person. In Daniel 4, verses 34 through 36, when the 7 years had passed, said the king, I looked up at the sky and my sanity returned. I praised Elyon, the Most High, and gave honor and glory to the one who lives forever. He will rule forever, and his kingdom will last for all time. He looks on the people of the earth as nothing. Angels in heaven and people on earth are under his control. No one, now he's really saying there, no one, not even me, can oppose his will or question what he does. And in verse 36, he says, when my sanity returned, notice that, when my sanity returned, this is such a beautiful example of what we would call being born again. That's what Jesus said to Nicodemus. Imagine instantly going from being an animal to being a man. Take any animal you can think of and changing that animal into a man. That's impossible. But imagine, this is what happens to Nebuchadnezzar. But new birth means we are taken from a state of a fallen, helpless, dead sinner to be seated in the heavenlies with Christ. With a change of mind and heart, we experience that is truly great. Truly great. We can't explain it. Then he goes on, because it is even more amazing, and he's exalted even more. Because he says, not only my sanity returned, but it goes on, he says, my honor, my majesty, and the glory of my kingdom were given back to me. But he's going to view that, he's going to view his all this in a totally different way. My officials and my noblemen welcomed me, and I was given back my royal power with even greater honor than before. And this is greater honor, but with even greater humility. Because here's what he now says. And now I, in verse 47, and now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, honor, and glorify the King of heaven. I do it. Everything he does is right and just, and he can humble anyone who acts proudly, as if saying, and that is exactly what he did to me. This is his commitment of loyalty to this great God, this Elyon, this Most High. And he's no longer in charge of his own life. See, when he says, my kingdom, my power, my honor, he says, not that, yeah, but that's mine now on this earth, but it's all under his control. He's no longer in charge of his own life. One he sees as greater is really in charge. And you know, that's it. Nebuchadnezzar died. He passed from the world scene and he entered into glory. But he left behind a testimony, a legacy that we see in his son. We see that in his son, named Ewell-Merodach. And Ewell-Merodach, we find him in 2 Kings 25:27. It says this: in the year that Ewell-Merodach became king of Babylonia, he showed kindness to King Jehoiachin of Judah by releasing him from prison. See this? His son, Nebuchadnezzar's son, showed kindness to the king who carried the curse of the line of Judah, that Coniah curse we talked about last time. This is kindness he does not deserve. But who of us can say that God treats any of us as we deserve? But that legacy that he left to Ewell-Merodach, that legacy does not affect the next son, King Belshazzar. King Belshazzar is even more proud and more arrogant than his forefathers. Example, big party in the palace. Daniel chapter 5, verse 2. Big party. Verse 2. While they were drinking, Belshazzar gave orders to bring in the gold and silver cups and bowls which his father, which would be his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar had carried off from the temple in Jerusalem, so that he, his noblemen, his wives, and his concubines could drink from them. This is the famous handwriting on the wall incident. You've all heard of this. I'm not going to cover the whole chapter. I'm just going to make one point. Daniel comes in. He reviews Nebuchadnezzar's story of God casting him out to eat like grass, like an animal, driving him away from human society. And he goes through all that before Belshazzar, and he ends with this statement in verse 5:21. He says this: finally, he admitted that Elyon, that's the word Most High, the great God, controls all human kingdoms and can give them to anyone he chooses. But you, his son, have not humbled yourself, even though you knew all this. That's in 5:22. Even though you knew all this. See, he knew this. The whole family did. Someone like Nebuchadnezzar, who is born again and is radically changed, and there's a legacy in his son, you deny this? But Belshazzar, he is not humbled by this. Neither is he exalted by anyone but himself. Still, he treats Daniel as if he, not the Lord, has the final say, as he magnanimously rewards Daniel for his interpretation. He's not in control anymore. Look at this, 5:30. That same night, Belshazzar, king of Babylonia, was killed. He was killed. He was out of time, completely out of time. I hope you can see why I say that Nebuchadnezzar is the greatest Gentile king who has ever been or ever will be. The great power, a great ego, a magnificent kingdom, one that stood as the head of gold. But when he is fully confronted with the one true Most High God, he is humbled into the dust. And by the miracle of God's grace, his sanity returns. He stands up like a man. He praises the God who has saved him from the worst enemy he ever had, himself. Agree with me or not, it is a great story about a truly great man of history. It's also a story of God. God humbles the exalted, sometimes in grace, sometimes in judgment. And he exalts the humble, always in grace, always to the astonishment of the proud. And who is the most exalted king? Who is the most exalted Lord? Our Lord Jesus. Why? He chose to leave his glorious relationship with a loving Father from all eternity to come down into our wilderness and to live as someone who is far below him. He took on human form, far more humiliating than God driving Nebuchadnezzar into the fields as a beast. Jesus suffered humiliation far worse than eating grass in a field. He was tortured. He died naked. He died in total humiliation, mocked by men who David describes as beasts in Psalm 22. And now he is exalted far above all things because he went lower than any of us could have ever imagined. And Jesus did all of this for us. Our penalty for sin is paid. We are exalted in him, but only if we, like Nebuchadnezzar, look up and acknowledge Jesus as the Most High God. We are carried from the realm of dark beasts into the kingdom of light, far above all, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Let's pray. Dear Father, what a marvelous thing how your plan for a great and powerful Gentile king can involve a captive teenager who commits himself to you. But this is the way you work. Please help us to see that if we are simply humble and faithful as we come to meditate on your word, as we love those around us, as you do, you will do in our lives things we cannot even imagine. Give us the light of your wisdom day by day so that we can act and so that we can act with courage. Then you can exalt us and prosper us even in this life for the sake of Jesus, because he is our Elion. Amen.